Well, welcome again to Grace Church this weekend. On this weekend, with all the events and all the chaos that's going on around our state, I hope that you are safe and cared for. We have a storm and we have evacuations, and it has given us, of course, my family's not evacuating because they know best. So there's that. A lot of people are, and it's given us a great opportunity to be able to pray for folks and now be able to serve folks through the storm, after the storm, and to be able to care for folks in our area and in the lower part of the state and for those around us. So as many of you know, on our different campuses, our TR campus meets in a high school, and so they've been closed out of that school, and Anderson meets in elementary school, North Point, and they have been closed out of that school, and so we've moved them to other campuses. So that's a nice benefit of having people in the same church worshiping on different campuses. We can share those resources, so that's good. And one other church in the state that got, I mean, there's a bunch, but at least one that got closed out of their school for this weekend is a brand new church, Grace City Church in Charleston, which is a church plant that just happened. They spent a year getting ready for their first service, and they're being stormed out of their second service. And so I was giving them a hard time. You had one service, and you've already canceled. So let me show you some pictures. This is Ashley River something Creative Arts Elementary School, where they meet. It has 75 entrances where they had to man all that. And they had 325 people come to their first service. I'm like, this is 4 years of work for me. They did in one weekend. Am I good with that? No, I am not good with that. So it was incredibly exciting. They worship hard, and so it was great. And then they had this really good-looking guy get up, do about 5 minutes, pray for them. That was a great moment. That church is going to do great. I don't know what to say. We are really excited. We really are for the launch of Grace City Church in Charleston. These are good folks, Will and Mally, and a team of folks, some of which left Greenville, moved down there to be able to share in that work. And other people in the Charleston area are coming on board. And so it's great. I mean, who knows how it's all going to go? I do want to be clear on this. A couple of conversations I've had. This is a separate church from us. This is not a campus. We have all our campuses in the upstate. I have no responsibility in Charleston, is what I'm trying to tell you, right? This is a separate church, and we are thrilled. It's like having a child. We reproduced as a church. Our child grew up and moved away. So we have lots of influence, and our fingerprints are there, but they are an independent church. They're going to have their own elders. They're making their own decisions. Will does make me work for him quite consistently, but technically, they are a separate church. What we are doing in way of emotional support and serving them and whatever they need, they get when they ask. We are giving them, for the first 2 years, $50,000 a year to help backbone what they're doing. They have some money. A lot of people in our church have given directly to them. That's been great for a season. Don't do that anymore. But going forward, give. It's great. We are giving them $50,000 a year to help them get going. They have some people there. They're doing great with their resources. They're stewarding all that well. And I just want to tell you that because when we pull our resources, when we give together, we can do things that you can't do by yourself. Now, when you go give money by yourself somewhere, and I'm not saying don't do that. We have things that we give that are outside the local church. But the giving of the New Testament is in the context of local church under authority where we pull resources. When we give all our resources together, we plant churches in Papua New Guinea. I can't do that by myself. When we pull our resources, we help plant a church in Charleston. We do ministry in Allendale. We do ministry in Greenville. We're doing things in Kenya. It's amazing the opportunities that we have when we pull our resources, not to mention the discipleship that happens in our walls. And so I think they're a good investment. I think what we're doing as a church is a good investment. I think we're doing what God wants us to do. But here's what I'll tell you. This is the most proud moment for this kind of spiritual father in the moment. We were, after the service, this happened twice. I was with two different groups of leaders from Grace City Church, Charleston. And we were just like, this is a bunch of people. And on two different occasions, two different leaders said, now we got to figure out a way to disciple and shepherd and care for these people. And so I was like, then that's what we're talking about. That's what the church is supposed to do. We are reaching people, but we are discipling and caring for them and shepherding them. So that's a huge win. Very excited about it. Turn to Genesis 29. I have about an hour-long sermon. I'm going to squeeze it down into the next few minutes. And when I taught this passage when I was 27, I did not squeeze it down. I think it's about an hour and 5 minutes. So that is progress, my friends. We saw last week that Jacob got tricked by Laban, his father-in-law, the one who does all the tricking, got tricked. And it showed him that God is paying attention, that God is loving him and blessing him, but God is also disciplining him and shaping him. And there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus, yet the discipline is still real and it's very painful. This original promise to Abraham and to all his descendants that God will make Israel a great nation has been slow in coming, but we're going to pick up some steam this week. We're going to have some sons that'll be over those tribes, and so we'll get to see some progress. So let's look in 29. This is a long story. I'm going to read every bit of it because I want to, and I like it, right? And so I'm going to go fast, but verse 31 of chapter 29. When the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, he enabled her to have children, but Rachel could not conceive. So we have a world of pain. We have one woman who has love, and we have another woman who has children. If you have children in the ancient world, you are most blessed. They consider that God has looked on you, blessed you, given you children. The love of a husband, I'm sure, is important, but probably not as important as having children. So one woman has the love of her husband. Another woman has the love of has children and their love and feels blessed by that. One woman lacks the love of a husband. The other wife will lack having children. And so each has something good that they could anchor on. Each has something that's a loss for them. Verse 32, we're going to see this competition between Leah and Rachel unfold. 32, so Leah became pregnant, gave birth to a son. She named him Reuben, for she said, "The Lord has noticed my misery." So the names, all the names will be fed by the situation and the emotional experience. So it's not a written language at this time. It's a verbal. It's people sharing, you know, storytelling. And so how things sound is real important. So what they would do is there's a bigger phrase over there. They might pull a word out of that common phrase and build a name around it. Or they would name someone something that rhymes with or sounds like this other idea. And so that you would get the name of this person and you would get the other idea that existed in the culture. And so it either sounds like or has the root word brought in. So on this one, the idea of seeing or noticing, they grab the word seeing, noticing, or the root of that word, and she brings it over and names her child Reuben, because the one who sees, because God has seen her, God has noticed her. So she became pregnant. She gave birth to a son. She named him Reuben, for she said, "The Lord has noticed my misery. Now my husband will love me." Will he? Right? That's what she goes, "Now I had this child for this man, and now he'll love me." I mean, how many women in history have said that? Right? Will he? Maybe he will. Maybe he won't. But here's what we're seeing. Through her struggle, we see what she craves. And now that is true for all of us. In your struggle, in your loss, in your wound, in your pain, you see what you crave. It becomes real clear what you want, what you desire, not all of which are bad. Some desires are great. Some desires are less than great. Some are bad. Even good desires can get corrupted. But we see her craving, we see in her struggle, it reveals her desires. And so the question that's kind of starting to loom already is, will having these children fill the need in her soul? Will it? Will it cause her husband to love her in a way where she will feel affirmed? Because here's what I would say, it hasn't worked, and we haven't seen this part yet, but it's not going to work for Rachel. Because she has the love of her husband, and she still feels lost. So the whole idea, grass is always greener on the other side. The one you would think, if she could just get that, she'd be better. Well, the other woman has that, and she's not better. So that idea kind of looms for us. These are some legit desires, but they can become an obsession and an orientation around identity. 33. She soon became pregnant again and gave birth to another son. She named him Simeon. She said, "The Lord has heard." Now, this word has the root in it of hearing. God has heard that I was unloved and has given another son. So God is seeing her. God is listening to her. And notice that there is this expression of faith that you can see that she is expressing herself towards God. And it has a faithful kind of response. 34, she became pregnant a third time, gave birth to another son. His name was Levi. She said, surely this time my husband, notice this every single time, talking about this husband. Surely this time my husband will feel affection. Levi has this idea in it of being joined or connected. So surely he'll feel connected to me or joined to me or feel affection for me since I have given him three sons. She's like, you know what? I am hitting home runs here. I mean, I'm having children. I don't know how to say it appropriately, so I won't say it. I'm having children here. And not just any kind of children. I'm having sons. I'm like three for three on this. Don't take offense. It's just a cultural issue, okay? I'm just telling you. I'm the reporter, all right? So she's like, I'm hitting it out of the park. I am performing amazingly well. And so she's performing well, and she's like, surely this earns me something. How many of you have thought that you were going to work and you were going to perform and gain somebody's approval? I mean, not everybody has done that, but a lot of us have. Only to be shocked that no amount of excellent performance could win the day or earn favor with that dad or that mom or that brother or that sister or that friend or that group of friends or that group of people or that organization that I want to be a part of, that no amount of excellent performance actually won the day. And that is what she is thinking. I am crushing this. And he's still not paying attention to me. So let's do it again. 35. Once again, Leah became pregnant, gave birth to another son. She named him Judah. She goes, now I'll praise the Lord. And she stopped having children. It does feel like there's a turn right there. His name means praise. And it looks like she's saying, okay, I'm good. I'm not going to be able to win him over, and it's okay. I don't need the love of this man. I am content with the love of a father. That's what it looks like. Now, here's what's going to happen. The pressure's going to build again, and she's going to fall back into it. But at least at this moment, it looks like there's progress. What we would say in New Testament terms is that she's going to find Jesus died on the cross to pay for my sins. He wipes my old identity out. I gain a new identity in him. Not just my sins wiped away for all eternity, being in a right relationship with God, but a new identity because I've trusted in him. And now I live out of that identity, not something that I need or something that I create. That is a dramatic shift from a performance mentality. That would be ideal. And it looks like she's moving in that direction. We're going to see her slip back again. But let me just show you what's going on with our we got four players. Now, we haven't introduced Zilpah and Bilhah yet, but we have Leah. And so Leah just had a few children here. And so she's doing well. We got four out of the gate right here, right? So let's keep reading together, and we'll build the list as it goes. Chapter 30, verse 1. When Rachel saw that she wasn't having any children for Jacob, she became jealous of her sister. So what's driving? Jealousy. She pleaded with Jacob, give me children or I will die. And so jealousy is driving her. Envy is driving her to put demands on people and put pressure on people around her who cannot produce. This man cannot produce what she wants. She is demanding something from a husband that he cannot give her. So it's an interesting idea that we do this too. When we get pinched, when we start suffering, we feel wounded, we'll start placing demands on a husband or a wife or on children or on a career to meet needs that are deep inside of us, that there's no way those things can bear the weight of our soul. It's the number one thing you want to work on in premarital. It's be like, you got to adjust your expectations. There's no way this woman can meet all those needs in your life. There's no way you can put pressure on this man to be able to satisfy all those needs and make you feel that way. That is not what he's going to be able to do. And so you'll see us turn. You'll see people turn towards other relationships, drugs, alcohol, pornography, hobbies. They'll turn to something else that'll meet that need. What we would want is, she goes, give me children, and being driven by this jealousy, what we would want is for her to have an expression of faith that would take her in a different direction. She says, she became jealous of her sister. She pleaded with Jacob, give me children or I will die. Here's the problem, though, and we'll talk about this, the faith, more in a minute. But here's the problem with an expression of faith in the face of a wound like this. Here's the challenge of it. Is that if you, instead of going and taking matters into your own hands and trying to respond in jealousy and put pressure on people, get what you want, this is what I want, it's what I deserve, instead of doing that, fate turns you away from your desires and turns you back towards God. But the problem is, it turns you back into the hands of a God that you can't control. That I have found is the most frustrating part. Because this, I can work on a way to control it. But faith makes me turn my back on that and runs me back into the arms of a God that does not obey me and may not give me what I want. And so I have to contend with him. And this loss makes me restless. But if you can work through the faith on the other side of it, with faith, work through it, it gets you to a place of rest. But notice what she says, give me children or I will die. When your idol will not produce, which they don't, they sell you an idea, and then it leaves you hungry. It leaves you desolate. It leaves you in despair. It feels like death. She goes, give me children or I will die. It definitely feels like death. And most of us have felt that. Most of us had to come to the end of ourselves where our idol did not produce, and it felt like death. Verse 2, then Jacob became furious with Rachel. He became furious. He said, am I God, he asked. He goes, he's the one who's kept you from having children. Now all of a sudden he's become a theologian, right? I mean, let me tell you about God's sovereignty, and I am not sovereign. She needs compassion. She probably does need the truth, but we've all felt this too. We've all felt a spouse or a child or a parent or a friend or someone tried to put weight and pressure on us that we couldn't bear up under. All of our staff, our pastors on our staff, they've all felt that. That someone tries to put something on you, they bring in their family. They've been destroying their family for 15 years. And then they say, now we want to come to the church so you can fix us. Fixing is not what we do. That is not our specialty. That's what God does. We are much more preventative maintenance. That's what we are, right? We are training along the way. We don't have magic wands. So I need you to do this for me. He becomes furious under the weight of that. Verse 3. Then Rachel told him, take my maid Bilhah and sleep with her. She will bear children from me, and through her I can have a family too. So we saw that Sarah, earlier in this book, did this with Abraham. She couldn't have a child. God said, I'm going to give you a child. And she's like, maybe we could do this. And he's like, no, maybe we could do this. And so finally she comes with the idea to get her maid, take her to Abraham. They could have a child together. They do that. It doesn't work out so great, right? But she did do that. So here's where we are. This is a culturally acceptable practice. We have the model in Adam and Eve of what God wanted, one man, one woman. The culture moved away from that. These folks, though they are believers of the true God, they have fallen into that cultural practice. But here's what I want to tell you. There's no law yet that specifically says don't do it. But I think they probably know what God wants, and they're not doing exactly that. But here's what I want to challenge you. Do not get lost on that idea. Do not get caught up judging them because they do marriage a little bit differently, because it would be easy to get lost on that idea and start judging them. Here's what I'm going to tell you. In 1,000 years, people are going to look at our culture and they're going to judge us because we're caught up in something cultural that 1,000 years from now, they're going to look at it and be like, can you believe they did that? And we don't know what that is yet because we're like fish swimming in water. That's our culture, and that's what we know. So let's don't get lost judging on them. I mean, I don't know what it's going to be. In 1,000 years, they're going to be like, you know, those people had like multiple cars. And you're like, they did? Yeah, they did. Did they know people were starving? They did. But they still wasted money on all that stuff anyway. Or they'll say, that country was like only in existence for like 300 years. You know how many people they killed in 300 years? Nobody in history has killed as many people as they did. I don't know what they're going to judge us by, right? But here's what I would say. That's not the problem in this passage, so don't get lost on it. The sin of this passage, sin is not the problem in this passage. The problem in the passage is that she took matters into her own hands, and a passive man lets her do it. But that's the real issue here, is that she circumvents what God is doing to get what she wants based in her own drive, based in her own envy, based in her own jealousy. You're like, well, God's going to use it to create the tribes. Sure, he is. That's what he always does. We're not responsible for what God's doing. We're talking about what we're doing. The motivations, the drives, the desires that we have. She circumvents the system. She goes, She said, take my maid Bilhah and sleep with her. She'll bear children for me. And through her, now I can have a family. Because who's it about? It's about her. It's about me. Forget the fact that I'm going to take this child from this woman. I get to have a child. And here's what I'm telling you. We're still doing this with fertility. Now, there's a lot of fertility techniques that are great, right? But there are some things in the world of fertility that are over the line. You go, where's the line? I don't know where all that is. I just know some things that I read about, that I research, that I talk to people, some of it is not. So we're still doing this. But we're taking shortcuts in every area. Some of you have gotten promotions in your business, and you don't want anybody to know what you did that no one else knows about or that one other person knows about to get that. Some of us desperately do not want anybody to know what we did to build that business. Some of us don't want anybody to know what we've done to be a part of this group or to have that relationship or to be with them, to be in the mix on that. So we know what this is, to be able to circumvent, take a shortcut to try to get what we want because we're so driven by it. Verse 4. So Rachel gave her servant Bilhah to Jacob as a wife, and he slept with her, and Bilhah became pregnant and presented him with a son. Rachel named him Dan, for she said, God has vindicated me. She's like, it was a great idea. I knew it. And everything worked out great. And so she names him Vindication. God has vindicated me because this was a brilliant idea. And I came up with it, and everything has worked out great. And that's how it goes. There can be, when you want to control something, manage it, override it, manipulate it, scheme it, get what you want, the way you want, when you want, how you want, there can definitely be some short-term success. There's no doubt about that. You make it work for a while. But there are always some long-term consequences to all of that. And so we have families that work really hard to make their children successful because they don't want their children to fail, so they're not letting their children fail. So they're giving their children some short-term success, but it is short-circuiting the mental, emotional, spiritual development of those children. And so there is short-term success, and there's long-term failure many times. I talked to a guy a long time ago, years ago. He said, I need some help with my marriage, and he and I talked, and I met her, and we talked a little bit, and their stories I couldn't make sense of the story. And so I said, I need you to tell me the story again about how y'all got married. He goes, okay, here's the real story, because I couldn't get a straight answer on some stuff. They went out. He pursued her at an event, and she said, look, he goes, let's go out. She said, there's no need for us to go out. I would never marry anybody like you, which I do appreciate the honesty on day one. And it was really just a matter of profession. She was looking for someone who was headed in this direction of life, and he was headed in a different direction. Neither one bad. It's just what she was real clear on what she wanted. He said, and I took that as an absolute challenge. And I was like, she can't. Nah, I'm going to win. And I was like, you did? He said, yeah. He goes, so I set out to prove to her that what I was doing and who I am is just as valid as all that. And it was actually, she wanted to be married to somebody in some kind of ministry, and he was in world of banking. And he said, I was going to prove to her that this is just as valuable as this over here. I was like, And so he did. He went to work and tried to win her over, and did win her over, and they got married, and they hated each other. I mean, it was one of the oddest situations. And so he got this thing in his head to prove and to validate and to gain affirmation, and made both of them miserable in the process. And they are neither miserable now because they're not together anymore. But that is the thing that you can do. You can have some short-term success and some long-term failure. And here's what I would tell you about controlling people as a species. We all have a certain amount of control in us. But if you're a person who has to control any and everything around you, let me tell you, you will end up alone. I've seen it 1,000 times. Controlling people end up alone because at some point, everybody around you has to break free of your gravitational pull so they can have a life. And to get free of all that, they got to leave you alone. That's just how it goes. And they still love you and they still care about you. Usually, they don't generally hate. They just got to get free of that force that holds over them. It's just a natural thing that happens. Verse 7, then Bilhah became pregnant again and gave Jacob a second son. Rachel named him Naphtali. She goes, I have struggled hard with my sister. Notice what does she say next? And I'm winning. She goes, I've been in a fight with my sister, and so she had the husband, and she had the children. She goes, now I went and got my maid involved, and now I got the husband, and I got children too. So we went to war, and I am winning. And here's what I would tell you. They did go to war, but she's not been really fighting with her sister. As much as that is true on an earthly level, she really been fighting against God. That's who she's been fighting against. And that is not going to go well. I've done it. It isn't great. So let's catch up on our list. So now you can see Zilpah, who will come in a minute, is related to Leah, right? And then Bilhah works for Rachel. So you can see we're starting to build the family here. It's dysfunctional, but we are building the family. We're getting something done. Verse 9. Meanwhile, Leah realized she wasn't getting pregnant anymore. She's like, holy cow, we got other people starting to have children. So she says, I'm going to get back in the game. And this is where she slips back. We saw that moment with Judah. Looked good. She's coming out of it. She falls back into it. So she took her servant Zilpah. She gave her to Jacob as a wife. Soon Zilpah presented him with a son. Leah named him Gad, for she said, how fortunate I am. That jealousy creeps back. She goes and gets another child. Competition, craving that validation through Zilpah. Then verse 12, then Zilpah gave Jacob a second son. Leah named him Asher, for she said, what joy is mine. Now all the women will celebrate me. What women are going to celebrate with you? Your sister? No. No one's going to celebrate with you. But you see what she's still craving, that kind of affirmation, using these children to get this. Now these women will celebrate with me. What joy is mine? We do the same thing with sports, work, family, using it, your musical, your music, your creative ability, your intelligence. We will use anything for affirmation. So let's add her. So now we got two more. So we're filling it out. Verse 14, now pay attention to this. This is a cultural thing that's not part of our world. Verse 14, one day during the wheat harvest, Reuben found some mandrakes growing in the field and brought them to his mother. Rachel begged Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. Mandrake would be considered some version of an aphrodisiac, whether the way it looks, the way it smells, or if there's some just random attachment to it, like a horseshoe, we say in our culture, has luck associated with it. The mandrake has sexual reproduction attached to it in some way. So we don't understand how it all works. We just know that that's how they felt. So we don't know how it gets there. That's just what it is. Verse 15. Leah angrily replied, isn't it enough that you stole my husband? So notice the nature of the relationship. That's how she views it. You stole my husband. She goes, now you'll steal my son's mandrakes too. Rachel, you're a thief. You already have his love. You have his affection. So you took him from me, and now you're messing with my kids. All you do is steal. So this is the nature of the relationship. The wounds are not just in the past, and you've experienced this with someone who's hurt you. The wounds just keep on coming at Christmas, on vacation, when you get together, at work, whatever. The wounds just keep on coming. Rachel answered, now listen to this. Now you want to talk about some backwards thinking. Rachel answered, I will let Jacob sleep with you tonight if you give me some of the mandrakes. You're like, Rachel, hon, calm down. This is the man that you need to get you pregnant. You don't give him to your enemy because that's what he's going to do to her. Right? I mean, just the logic of it. We tell our fusion kids, sin makes you what? They go, stupid. So that's what we teach them. For years, we told our kids not to use the word stupid until they got to fusion, fifth and sixth grade. Then they come home, I get to say stupid finally. Sin makes you stupid. This thing is going to backfire on her, but this idea has become her identity. It's become her obsession. Verse 16, so that evening, Jacob was coming home from the fields. Leah went out to meet him. You must come and sleep with me tonight, she said. I have paid for you with some mandrakes that my son found. So that night he slept with Leah. Ladies, I'll just tell you this. On behalf of men everywhere, it is frustrating when you use us for our bodies. I just had to get that out there. It's we got to draw the line somewhere, right? Verse 17. And let it go. And this is interesting. Notice the first phrase. And God answered Leah's prayers. We have people who are making bad decisions. And God is not making those bad decisions. They're making those bad decisions. But God is right in the middle of it. There are things about what is happening and that he's involved in all of it. And there are some prayers that he is answering. She became pregnant again and gave birth to a fifth son for Jacob. She named him Issachar, for she said, God has rewarded me for giving my servant to my husband as a wife. And so Leah sees it as a reward. She sees it as a reward. Even God isn't, I don't understand how God's involved in all this, but he is. Then Leah became pregnant again. She gave birth to a sixth son for Jacob. She named him Zebulun, for she said, God has given me a good reward. Now my husband will treat me with respect, for I have given him six sons. She goes, I'm hitting home runs like crazy. Later she gave birth to a daughter and named her Dinah. She says, so this is all a reward. And so we have them all. We put them up too soon, but we have all of them listed right there. She cannot give it up. She cannot quite give up the idea, this desire. And here's what I would tell you. This is a different sermon for a different day, but write this down. Here's the question you have to ask yourself. This is at the heart of this idea. Is what is the line between striving, manipulating, scheming, working to get what you want, your desires overtaking you, becoming your obsession, your identity, your orientation, where you will sacrifice anything and anybody to get what you want, that striving, where's the line between that and persevering? Where it means, and persevering is more about being steadfast in your faith, waiting on God, working hard on the things that you can work on, but being steady. Doesn't mean you're not doing anything. There are things that we can work on and give ourselves to and really work hard. But there is a steadfast, steady perseverance waiting on God. Those things are different. They seem to get close. It seems to be on the striving side, I'm alone getting what I want. On the persevering side, it seems that I am steady waiting on God and I am under the authority of the word and I'm under the authority of community. It seems to be that that's part of the dividing line. And I'm not hiding with my agenda. A man separates himself because of his own desires, Proverbs says. Not separating myself, not pulling myself away, but staying in community, under the authority of community. When they say, this is not a good idea, then I trust the people in my biblical community more than I trust myself. I trust the word more than I trust myself. Something about that is on the perseverance side. Something about hiding and getting what I want all the time seems to be on the striving side. Then verse 22. Then God remembered Rachel's plight, and he answered her prayers by enabling her to have children. And she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. God has removed my disgrace, she said. And she named him Joseph, for she said, may the Lord add another son to my family. So now Rachel has actually had a child of her own. And embedded in his name is, may he add another. And I don't think it's a lack of legitimate celebration. I think she's celebrating the fact that she has a child, but it's not enough. Right? May God add another. And God is going to add another. And that's going to be a whole other part of the story that's going to be challenging. So she prays. God answers her. She celebrates that. And so we have this complicated family dynamic. We have multiple women involved. We have multiple sons. There'll be multiple agendas. It's interesting to me, though, that she says this. God has removed my disgrace at the birth of Joseph. Which tells you she knows that what she was doing before wasn't right. Because the disgrace is not being able to have a child, culturally. That was her disgrace. So she was, through Bilhah, having children, yet she still felt the disgrace. So she knew that what she was doing was not relieving the pain. It was not filling the void. It was not building her identity. It was not helping with her obsession. She took matters into her own hands, and it still was not making things better. That is a word for our culture. We have more power, more money, more resources, more influence, more ability to control than anybody in history. If anybody needs to hear the message that taking matters into my own hands to get what I want, to fulfill myself, to fulfill my desires, to make me happy so I can have what I want, and having that kind of control, that will not work for you long term or make you happy. Matt Williams needs to hear that. Because I like to marshal energy and let's go and let's do this, whatever. Right? And we are full of that as a culture. And it is not just a female thing, it's a male thing, female, it's all of us, right? It's all of us. So let me give you some things to think about. This is we're getting ready to have the starting 12, the original starting 12 football team for Israel. But if you're in Israel and you're hearing about this while you're wandering through the wilderness, you're thinking, so that's how we got started, which explains why we have so many problems. So let's just let that be a point of, okay, good. That's who we are. We're that broken. That's who we are as God's people. We're that broken. The questions to think about, if I were boiling it down, is what is the dream? What is the dream that you're tempted to sacrifice anything for? You will compromise, you will sacrifice, you will shave the edges off. What is the dream? Is it grades? Is it school? Is it a job? Is it a certain achievement? Is it marriage? Is it children? Is it success? Is it to be loved by someone? Is it to be accepted by a certain group of people? What is it that drives you, the void that's deep in you, that the Father's love could fill, that a new identity in Christ could fill, but that you cannot? And no matter how much pressure you put on yourself or the people around you, you will not accomplish it. You will not fill that void. Or what's the wound that drives you? What's the wound that you got cut? We can all remember a teacher or a parent or someone significant saying something to us that was not kind or that was critical of us at a young age, and you can hear it just like it was yesterday. You know exactly what they said. We get marked. We get wounded. But is there a wound that you have built your identity around? Is there a loss? Is there a failure? Is there an inadequacy? Is there something that you don't feel like you measure up on, and you've built your identity, your orientation, your life around that? And that's caused you maybe to be battling with yourself, or maybe to be battling with God, or maybe you think you're battling with someone else, but ultimately you are battling with God. That's who the battle's with. But you're blaming it on someone else. So what is that wound? Or what is it that you protect at all cost? It's now yours. This is now mine. And I'm not giving that up. I'm managing this. I'm riding herd over all this. I got all this. No one can touch this. God better stay back. I can remember one of my good friends saying, he was the first of all our friends to have a child, a little girl. And I said, what's it like? He goes, there's a part of me, he goes, it's so amazing having this little baby. He goes, but there's a part of me that's just like, God, I need you to stay back because you might not take care of her the way I'm going to take care of her. I just need you to keep your hands off of her. He goes, I know that's wrong. He goes, this is how I feel. It's my gut. It's to be overly protective on all that. What is it that you cannot live without? That is your idolatry. That is your functional God. That is what you're trying to get to meet those deep needs, and it's going to leave you in despair. It'll leave you dry. Let's pray. There's lots to think about. Father, would you speak to us in our disgrace that we are working to remove sin and guilt and shame. We are working to add significance and wholeness and completeness to ourselves, and we have nothing to really offer. We have no amount of pressure on ourselves, no amount of pressure on other people can make up the difference, but you can. And so a new identity in you, to be guilt-free and to be a son of you, to be your son, to be your child, to be your bride, that gives a new identity and new life and new hope. And so, Father, would you show us what it means to turn away from our striving and turn towards you in faith and dependence and learn how to persevere, be steadfast in our relationship with you and waiting on you to provide for us in your time and your way. And we ask it in your name. Amen.